Thing so much earlier, now I'm like watching it like a hawk, and it's like, is that signal too hot? Usually I don't care enough. This is Pure Decking, show number 387 for Thursday. I hope it's Thursday. Haven't really been interacting with, you know, society much, so the computer says it's Thursday the 9th, you know, 2020, so we're gonna assume that the computers aren't lying to me, which is a dangerous assumption because I know how those same things work. And they do what they're told. It's just a question of who's telling it that. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and printing out a small photo of myself and taping it in front of the webcam so they think I'm paying attention at work. I'm Morps, and tonight I have Madman.
Hello. I don't think the computer can lie to you, because that requires intent. I think the computer can convey a lie that someone else told it to tell you.
I'm trying to decide if that's ant fucking or not, because you're technically correct.
Well, it's kind of like if you were a moron, and I were to tell you the moon is made of cheese, and you believed me because you had no reason not to, and you were to tell RU the moon is made from cheese, you're not lying to RU because you're intending to tell him a fact. You're just wrong.
Well, it doesn't.
The computer's kind of the same thing.
It does explain why we haven't been to the moon since the 60s.
Yeah, we found out it was made of the same rock down here on Earth, and we haven't figured out a really good use for a hydrogen goo except for blowing each other up. Now, once fusion becomes a thing, we're going to have strip mines on the moon. And I wish I could, you know, buy into that now, but I don't know which company would be able to pull it off, so I don't know who to invest in.
You'll be dead before your investment pays back, Madman.
Just wait and see who Elon Musk invests in, and then just, you know, go with that one.
I could leave the investment to, you know, grandchildren, and this is how billionaires happen overnight. It's like great-grandpa dumbass invested in space cheese. And it paid off, and now we're gazillionaires. Spent $1.75. I'm now worth $2 billion. Now at this time, a Big Mac might be worth $175, but still, it's going to be some money.
Planting a tree you never intend to sit under. My way to go. I can get behind that.
Speaking of getting behind things, RU is here.
Yeah, once again. Is that it? I don't have anything clever. No. No whips, no quips.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to find anything clever. I mean, all the news stories are related to the great sneeze forward in one way or another.
Yeah, and really, if you're not doing anything, you're just, you know, pretty much rinse and repeat the same shit from yesterday, but hope it goes a little quicker and try not to drink, you know, 3/5 of that bottle tonight.
So you're saying I should already be slowing down, right?
No, I'm fucking not passing judgment on anyone. You do what you want to do, man. Fucking end of days, you know. Is this the time to get sober? When's that asteroid meant to hit us?
I don't know. There was a really bad movie. It's the one where global warming caused North America to become a glacier.
Oh, tomorrow or something.
Yeah.
Day after tomorrow?
That might be it. The whole thing was about a guy who was a mountain climber, and he was hiking across the frozen wasteland of North America because it froze overnight. The movie was terrible. Don't go see it. But there was a scene where they were in this British weather research station, and they were about to dump a whiskey or something into the heater, the oil heater, to keep them, you know, try to keep alive a little bit longer. And the guy in charge of the station said, no, fuck it. get the bottle out. We're just going to drink it.
Yeah.
And yeah. It was that part was actually a really good scene in that movie, and that stuck with me. The rest of the movie's garbage. Don't go see it. But, you know, don't go looking up, because it's all, you know, global warming, you know, propaganda, really. But that one scene was kind of cool. So, the whole, you know, British stiff upper lip thing, and just like, you know what, we're going to die here. We might as well enjoy the whiskey as opposed to burning it. So,
yeah, I'm sort of that mind.
Oh, I figured out how they could have stayed a little warmer longer. Well, they should have started burning freeze-dried animal dung.
In a kerosene heater?
Okay, on that one, it's going to be an open flame, but still. They have a kerosene heater. They have an ignition source for their campfire.
They were in some kind of a weather research station that was frozen over. So, like, they couldn't get out. But, anyways, like I said, terrible movie and probably full of plot holes like that. But, well, I guess we can just get into it. First article is from CNN Business. Psychro sent me another version of this article, but I had already had this one in the notes. I think the one he sent me was on a different site, though. Vice, maybe. Anyways, wanted urgently, people who know a half-century-old computer language so states can process unemployment claims.
Oh. Is that why so many states are having trouble? I just thought they were lacking manpower. No one ramped up for everyone that was unemployed during the 2008 financial crisis, like the entire recession. That
bullshit about
five
King
years,
Obama.
You then compress that to a month and have them all call in at once. I just didn't think they were ready for that. I had no idea it was because no one's updated their computer system since the 60s.
On top of ventilators, face masks, and healthcare workers, you can now add COBOL programmers to the list of what several states urgently need as they battle the coronavirus pandemic, also known as the bamboo burden. In New Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy has put out a call for volunteers who know how to code the decades-old computer programming language called COBOL, because many of the state systems still run on older mainframes.
Now, that's a word I haven't heard in a long time. Like, that language, COBOL.
Banks still kind of use it, but they've been moving away from it since, 2010.
More like the 90s.
New Jersey still has it?
I was
going
to say, man. Like, didn't they start getting out of that programming language around 95?
Well, they wanted to. Then they saw how expensive it was to move all the data around and build new systems. So, like any other good bureaucracy, they didn't.
Oh, dude.
So, here's the part about this that I think is hilarious. Put out a call for volunteers who know COBOL. No.
That's when I call them up. I'll volunteer to help you, but it's going to cost you $1 million.
Yeah.
If
you're in the driver's seat for leverage at that point.
If you are fluent enough in COBOL to work on these mainframe systems, because it's not just COBOL, you need to know. You need to know AS400, because that's most likely what they're running. You need to know their particular data sets. So you're talking about weeks of somebody just researching the system and hoping it's documented.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things are old enough that when they bought the software, that usually whoever put it together documented it because they were paid $1 million for the, for the consultancy, right? So, that's actually one of the reasons so a lot of these things are still around, is back in the 60s and 70s, these companies paid millions of dollars for these systems, which... Today, the bad part is a lot of the data crunching that these systems are doing, today you could do the equivalent work in Microsoft Excel and with a, you know, mid-range laptop. Now, I'm being a little mean here to these mainframes because these things have a lot more... how do you explain this in a way that makes sense? They have a lot more input-output lines, right? So they have a lot more parallel processing than your laptop. Your laptop, well, I mean, you can pull up Task Manager and see. You're going to have, on an average laptop, probably, you know, 4 to 8 cores and hyper-threading. So you're talking 8 to 16 simultaneous tasks with probably about 100 processors running on a modern Windows operating system. 100, 200 processes, give or take, depending on what all you've got installed and how much, you know, malware and junk you've got running in your system tray, right? So, but these systems are designed for servicing, you know, thousands of simultaneous users. So even though the processing power equivalent that a single user might get is going to remind you of a Commodore 64, you know, these things are equivalent to a couple thousand Commodore 64s duct taped together so that it can service all those individual users. So it's a different model. It's not the same, but yeah, the equivalent processing power of a lot of these systems is a, you know, mid-range workstation. And the math they're doing, you could do in something like Excel. You know, you've got these huge concurrency databases and things like that. So, I mean, it's a lot more complicated. But, yeah, for the amount of work they're doing, it's actually really frustrating when you go in and look at systems like this. Because I'm having to do this with, like, old Java code. And you look at what they're doing, and it's like, why are you running 10 servers, you know, high-end systems and maxing out your database calls and all this stuff when you could do all this equivalent work for your user base with, like, you know, just this little bit of modern stuff? Well, because the modern stuff didn't exist when they put it together, right? So, and you got to unravel all the bullshit and figure it out. So, you know, just to get up to speed on these systems, if they are documented, is a several week, if not a several month process. And if they're not documented, like years. If these things aren't documented, you're talking years of discovery work.
I don't know if they would still have the manuals.
Oh, surely. Somebody's got them somewhere.
Yeah, they'd be in the back cupboard, basement somewhere.
Well, that, or they'll have bits of it that they've photocopied and handed out to the people using the thing every day. It's like, here's how you do this, here's how you do that, where they've taken that manual and turned them into, like, work instructions, right? But the last time I had to deal with an AS400 seriously, it was not a real AS400. It was one being emulated by an IBM power system because the actual hardware had died years ago. But you just had a handful of people who knew that system. And they knew what screens were what, and they knew what database calls. Well, it wasn't a database, a data set, and then you had addresses. Anyways. But, yeah, it was one of these things where, yeah, they had documentation at one point, but the two people in charge of it had chopped it up and made their own. And, you know, so it was really fun making sense of anything, right? But, so that's a very real problem. So, you know, months to get up to speed with these systems is not unusual, because the other reason why these guys can command such a high fee, if you've got somebody who's experienced with the proper mainframe and COBOL and you know how these systems generally work, it's because they're so rarefied and they're so specialist that, I mean,
he might not have a job again for a couple of years. You're paying for all of that time.
Possibly.
Or work.
I mean, that's entirely possible. And if you talk to any mainframe guys, you know, I've spoken with some guys at different conferences who they live on mainframes. And you figure out really quickly that mainframe is really just a different computing model anymore. They're largely using comparable hardware. It's not the same. I almost said the same, and like that's a burning at the stake, but it's not. But it is comparable, because a lot of times the same hardware that they're running the mainframe system on is actually a different, you know, a more modern system that's just emulating the mainframe system that can also emulate Windows and can also emulate Linux, right? So, or Unix, or you know, whatever they can you know throw different operating systems at it, but it's just a different model, different paradigm, and so they'll have all these different terms that once you kind of get the lexicon down and figure out what they're talking about, it's like, oh, I gotcha. But you know, if you use the PC terms, they get all elitist on you. So, and I mean PC isn't computing, not politically correct, because I don't blame somebody for getting elitist if somebody gets up there and starts talking about their privilege, right? So, anyways.
You clearly haven't used Linux for a while.
Are you? I use Linux just about every day.
They changed the language of all that shit?
Well,
make it more politically correct?
Yeah, they added a code of conduct to kernel maintenance, and they've been trying to get nicer about it. And at one point, they were talking about changing some terminology of different server systems. So now, instead of a master and slave, clustering system, now it's provider and subscriber.
I know, it's great, hilarious,
and you know. It's like, you do realize most of these names come from people playing D&D or Ultima and just going with the theme. They're called, why do you think they're called demons? Because it comes from the old school idea of wizards having little demons that run around and do things for you. Do you know why modern databases call it sharding? Because Ultima Online developed a lot of the initial ideas of breaking up databases and realms across multiple hardware to deal with all the players, because they were one of the first MMOs. And because, you know, they were breaking a realm into shards that could run on different servers, they called it sharding, because they were sticking with a fantasy theme. And now you go in Elasticsearch and some of these other modern NoSQL databases, and it's, oh, how many shards do you have? And you know, all this other stuff, and nobody knows why it's named that. It's like the save icon. Nobody knows that's a fucking floppy disk. They just like, I don't know, a little thing with a box on it. That's what means save, right? So,
well, I don't need to learn anything else today. I've learned my one thing.
I love that. You just limit it to one thing?
One thing a day, madman. I don't want to tear myself out.
No, especially if it's coming from me, because half the time it's not useful, so I don't blame them. So anyways, in Kansas, Governor Laura Kelly said that the state's Department of Labor was in the process of modernizing from COBOL to the then, but then the virus interfered. So they're operating on really old stuff, she said. They were in the process of something that should have started in the 90s.
That was a lie.
That's two states.
Connecticut also has admitted that it's struggling to process large volumes of unemployment claims with its 40-year-old system composed of a COBOL mainframe and four other separate systems. Oh, so that's even worse. Not only do they have an old COBOL mainframe, they duct taped other shit into it. Which means at some point, somewhere, it's getting written out to a file server and then read in somewhere else. Good luck figuring that shit out. It's always fun.
That's a custom job.
Yeah.
No, Madman, that was my point earlier. When it comes to these kind of mainframes and COBOL systems,
they're all custom jobs.
Maybe there's a job, start a company.
Hey, you know.
Specializing in swapping that stuff out.
You know, the thing is.
People are starting to see the limitations of their networks and stuff now.
If I could get my hands on some example systems to try to develop some processes and to develop some actual usable software methodology for doing this kind of shit, you'd make mint if you showed up with a consultancy for transitioning COBOL into like a modern Java or some other system, right?
I'm pretty sure if you rang some of these municipalities and said, hey, I'm thinking I'm wanting to get into this, and do you think you could pass me a data set to work on?
No, you need more than a data everything. Set. You need an IBM Power server running this shit.
Do you mind if I piggyback on the back of your Power server then?
They're going to say yes, because it has all these people's information in it, because they're still putting modern data in it. So modern data protection laws are going to prevent that unless you sign, or they'll put some horrendously expensive paperwork in front of you.
Yeah.
Not to mention the kind of errors of and omission insurance you would need to carry to even start such a company. There's a reason somebody else hadn't done it first.
Yeah.
Because it's hard.
See. Yeah.
Are we going to be running into the same problem again in 30 years?
We're going to be running into the same problem cyclically.
For the next 20 years.
I don't know how often that cycle is going to be, and it may vary, but yeah, because, I don't know, between the 80s and the 90s, we had a major shift in the way companies ran computer systems. You know, back in the day, early 90s, like, you know, everybody remembers going to the library and all they had was dumb terminals, or schools did that too. And they had, you know, you may not have known it was a dumb terminal, but you had a keyboard and a monitor and no computer. And it was usually orange text on a black screen, and it was all a text interface. That's a mainframe, usually running something like a COBOL on the back end, or something written in COBOL in the back end, right? Not necessarily. There were other systems, but generally that was it. So
/ /dir, enter.
Yeah, that command wouldn't. Usually, that's not it. They're usually all custom shells and software and shit.
That was the one I remember to get to the directory.
Yeah, I mean that's a DOS command. I mean,
that's all I remember.
So, let's see. Literally, we have systems that are 40 plus years old, New Jersey Governor Murphy said over the weekend. There'll be lots of postmortems, and one of them will be a list of how did we get here when we literally needed COBOL programmers. For instance, with more than 362,000 New Jersey residents filing for unemployment in the past 2 weeks, the 40-year-old mainframes that process those claims are being overloaded. coders have moved away from the aging language. COBOL, which stands for Common Business Oriented Language, is a computer programming language that was developed in 1959, according to the National Museum of American History. It's a programming language that was used to create a very significant percentage of business systems over the period of the 60s, 70s, and even in the 80s. Joseph Steinberg, an expert on cybersecurity, told CNN. But over time, coders have moved away from the aging language. The general population of COBOL programmers is generally much older than the average age of a coder, Steinberg said. Many American universities have not taught COBOL in their computer science programs since the 1980s. Despite the dwindling number of COBOL programmers, 2017 report by Reuters found that there are still 220 billion lines of COBOL in use today. 43% of banking systems are built on COBOL, and 95% of ATM swipes rely on COBOL code. You know, on previous shows, I've talked about having modern systems that are actually running screen scrapers against an AS400. It's usually so that they can interface with the COBOL code, because COBOL has no concept of how to talk to a modern system. So somewhere along the line, it gets turned into terminal calls or a file drop.
I know this is something we've railed against on the show, the whole software as a subscription model. Do you think that could end this problem?
Mm-mm.
If you're not owning it, the business that you're partnering with, staying continuously up to date, they'd be rolling over programs for you?
Yes, in theory. But software as a service is generally more expensive than running your own systems long term. So you're going to see a lot of companies not opt for it, at least established companies. But the real problem with these COBOL systems is getting your data out of them. So, you know, you think about the amount of records in these systems. Madman, where you work, I know for a fact there's an array of these things.
Oh, yeah.
Because I got one where I work, too.
I deal with the emulator that you're talking about on a daily basis.
Yeah, the 3270 emulator? Yeah. I loaded one of those up on a pocket PC one time, and it worked better than the damn desktop. Anyways, sorry. What's cool, though, is if you can get your hands on one of those old-school text terminals, they scroll text so much nicer than a modern system does when you're running the software. I don't know why. I don't know what that is. Maybe that's just nostalgia. But anyways, you think of the billions of records, transaction records, that are in that system, right?
Oh yeah, if you're, they're going down to the ATM model, there's dozens a day every time you swap your debit card.
Exactly. So you think of all, and the reason they still run these systems is because replacing them with a modern mainframe that can handle that many concurrent transactions is expensive. I mean, it is expensive. It's millions of dollars expensive. And even then, a lot of times it's still running the same damn code, even if you replace the hardware. So, you know, they just emulate the old hardware. And that's the thing, is a lot of these mainframe systems, what makes them a mainframe is that they're handling, you know, thousands of concurrent transactions. Whereas a modern PC-based system, even your big iron servers, they're still doing, you know, one instruction per core at a time, right? So that only scales so much. I mean, you remember going to the LAN parties we went to where we would knock servers over with a couple hundred people, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing, is an AS400 is not fast, but, you know, you're not going to knock it over with 1,000 concurrent users. 10,000 concurrent users, well, maybe, but, you know, that's the thing. It's, I mean, these things have as much in common with PCL programming as they do PC systems, because you're doing all these concurrent transactions, right? So you've got to design these systems that way. However, I am kind of wondering, let's just see, YouTube COBOL tutorial. For beginners, here we go. Does this exist? Yep, there they are. All kinds of them. Basics of running COBOL JCL and checking output on an IBM mainframe. Yeah, so it's all here. You could certainly learn COBOL if you wanted to. I was just curious if there are free resources, so I just went to YouTube and punched in COBOL tutorial. Of course, you know, halfway down it turns into Python tutorials, but, you know, hey, whatever. But yeah, it's on there, and I do know that there are emulators out there for, you know, making a computer pretend to be a mainframe so you can at least play with the environment. It's not going to run the same software, and you're not going to get that kind of concurrency. But if you're trying to just understand an environment, who cares? So let's see. Even in the federal government, and just to finish out the article here, even in the federal government, COBOL is still being used by agencies such as Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Justice, and Social Security Administration, according to a 2016 report by the Government Accountability Office. A 2018 report by the Inspector General for Social Security Administration found that the administration maintained more than 60 million lines of COBOL, with a million more lines of other legacy programming languages. The Inspector General urged the administration to modernize the systems. So governors should not have to think about their computer systems during a pandemic. Okay. Nothing else in here, just fluff. But the real problem from a technology standpoint is, how do you get your data out of there? So there's a couple of ways to do it.
Screenshot, print, scan.
Having an army of interns typing is a way to do it. Oh. Having them just have two screens up, one's the old system, one's the new, and just having them type. Now, how do you make sure that that data is all correct when you have millions of transactions to double check?
You have a second group of interns or employees, they call it second review, going over it.
And how much does it cost to run that kind of an operation for the years this will take?
For the years, oh God. But I know they run that type of operation when it comes to, let's say, something like a mortgage release.
Sure, but
but they're also getting paid for that for each mortgage. That's why closing costs exist.
Yep, yep. So
this is a sunk cost because you're not going to be able to charge these guys for anything else. You've already got their data.
So not only on top of that, of just getting that data moved from system to system, and making sure it's accurate, so now you've got to do a concurrency check. When do you switch over? Do you immediately switch to the new system and just tell people, sorry, your transaction history isn't going to be available till it gets moved into the new system, which could be years from now? Sorry about that. Or do you have people continue to operate on the old system till you have enough of the data into the new system that you can actually move into it? These kind of questions shut projects down.
Because somebody will say this is too hard, let's just leave it. Yeah, all of our new customers go immediately into this system. and then start slowly phasing old customers into the new system.
So great, now you got a maintenance problem where you're paying to maintain two systems paying to maintain one.
And that could be for a year or two, depending on how long it takes you to move your data.
And that's being optimistic.
But if you're a state government, and this is for your unemployment benefits that you're paying out, it would be in your interest to actually overhaul the entire thing. But while you're at it, throw a couple of forensic accountants at the system. See who's rotting it and who's not.
Oh, absolutely.
I think you could make a lot of your costs back through just going through and clawing back overpaid monies.
Potentially.
That's a potential. You're also looking at money from a stone agnia there. Like if somebody wanted to claw money from a broke person, it doesn't matter that that broke person owes you money. What matters is they can't pay it.
Well, they just don't receive any more until they've paid the outstanding balance.
Again, there's some potential there, but on top of this, there's other ways to do it. You know, rather than just having the army of interns moving data, right? Because then you also have data protection issues. What if you have sensitive data in there? What if you don't know you have sensitive data in there? You could do things like having it try to dump that data set out to files and then have other files. But you need a COBOL programmer to go in there and program that data dump, right? And then you need somebody who's fluent in a modern language to figure out how to collect that data and put it into a storage system that's useful, preferably some kind of structured data system. You don't want to just dump the whole thing into Elasticsearch, although I suppose that's an option. You generally want that to end up in some kind of a SQL language database. And then you need to write all the code to make your new processes in front of that. And so then you have a whole technical decision of what do I write that in? You know, you want it to be something that's going to last a while. And, you know, COBOL has a record of still going after 50 years. So, I mean, you know, it's you have a lot of hard problems to solve to get your data sets of size out of these old COBOL, you know, mainframe systems and into modern systems.
And this solution might not work again the next time you need to update.
Depending on what's changed, yeah. And again, you have that accuracy problem and concurrency if you have to run two systems at the same time. Because what if you're, you know, a 24/7, you know, global bank that doesn't get to shut the thing down for a weekend and move your data, right? And that's assuming that you physically can move that much data in a weekend. When you start getting into questions of you know large amounts of data, you get into the physics of moving that much information.
Oh, yeah, like electrons don't move that fast.
Right. So, I mean, I've had this problem where I work now, where we have file servers with terabytes of scanned documents on them. And these scanned documents are a couple of kilobytes a piece, right? They're TIFF images. And they're all, you know, you have like 50 terabytes of 1 and 2 kilobyte TIFF images. Do you know the logistics of trying to move that shit around?
Yes, that's part of what I do.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm doing research, there are several different branches and sometimes subcontractors doing research. So part of my job in research is if it's not something that already directly interfaces with the system, it might be me copying a file from one system to another system to upload into whatever database it needs to go into. Or if it's coming from the state and for some reason just doesn't directly go in anything, I print it off of whatever state system or website I'm on, scan it, email it to myself.
Now imagine doing that for every document in a system.
I don't that's do what it gets every, into. But I do it with batches. Like, I did that 71 times today. That was a job today.
Yeah. But that's my point is, like, okay, you did that 71 times. Now, there are millions of records in these systems that all have to get moved. And not all of them are going to be perfect fits for your data set because how you've used these systems is going to change over time. Because you'll have people who've started deciding that this field doesn't mean this anymore. Now it means this. And at some point, somebody updated some process instructions for that new usage of the field. So now you have old data mixed in with new data. So
and when you're going with banking, data that was required. There's data that wasn't required once that is required now for loan.
Yeah.
So you're going to have missing fields in older files or new fields in newer files.
So you have to somehow account for that, right? And so you get into a lot of these very difficult decisions that have to be made. Somebody has to sit down and suss out the logic of that because, okay, you bring in a high-end COBOL programmer and you bring in a high-end modern, you know, containerized Golang web developer who's familiar with cloud systems. And you don't give them any direction of what this data is, what these processes are, and how you need to move it, and just tell them you need to go from COBOL, from an AS400 to a modern system. Good luck getting anything that your business can actually use if you don't give them any guidance, because you don't, but you don't know, right? So that's the thing. You know, how many people Madman, how many people do you work with in your office who know that you put the data in this screen on this menu and have no idea why?
Oh, God.
Rough numbers. You don't need to be accurate. I'm using this as a fun example.
We're going to go, depending on the system, 12. It just goes there.
It just goes there in that system, right.
It's going to go up right now because we're transferring systems.
Now, how many do you think there's anybody in the company who actually understands what's going on in the background and could explain that in a useful manner to a systems engineer so that they can design the new system to take over that process?
Yes. And the only reason I say yes is we're changing systems right now and somebody had to have described this to the new vendor. Otherwise, we're getting a shit show of a system.
Actually,
I'm not going to know that till I'm trained.
That's actually a really good example. How long have you been working with the new vendor to try to figure out how to move your systems?
Oh, God. Working with them, 3 months.
Really? That's it?
It was a rush job.
Most of the time, you're talking years of discovery work to figure out all this crap.
We were told by our current vendor that they weren't going to support the current system anymore. And that was going to end at the beginning of last year. We were told that in October of last year.
Oh, great.
So the only reason it's gone this fast is it had to.
So
that's one reason we're like, this might work.
You might be getting a little too heavy into details just in case anybody else knows it, and I don't want anybody to get in trouble talking about work stuff. So I'm just going to stop you there. But for most things, when it's not a rush job, it's years. And so in your instance, because it is a rush job, what's going to happen is 6 months from now, somebody's going to go try to figure out, well, what replaced this process? And you're going to have a bunch of systems engineers looking at each other going, well, we didn't replace that process. And then your business, your banker is going to say, well, I have to do that process to meet X, Y, and Z requirement. What do I do? And you're going to have somebody scrambling to get that into the new system.
And literally, the new vendor is building the system around us as we're moving.
Yeah.
They don't even know what we're probably paying a shit ton more money than we need to.
Yeah, because you're doing the discovery as you go. Oh, my God.
We're paying, yeah. It's like, this is what we know we need. How much of it do you know you can do? We may have some more stuff later on.
What's worse than that is when you run into stuff that you don't do, but once every couple of years after that's all done, you better keep that vendor on retainer for a while is all I'm going to say.
One upside, it seems when certain industries don't look at what all has changed, they were able to automate a lot of stuff that we didn't have initially automated. Because we haven't looked at our system.
Sure. I mean, anytime you jump to new technology, you can do things like that, right? But and that's always a bonus. That's actually usually one of the selling points of moving to the new platform is it'll be easier. And sometimes it is, which is nice, especially if that data is in something that's a little bit more accessible so that you can do those kind of automations and workflows. But Oh, God, now I feel like I'm on a conference call for work. So why don't we move on?
Yeah, because we've gotten 43 minutes out of, what, that the second story?
Yep.
First.
Oh, I just posted the link for the second story, so that's what I was thinking. So this next one's from PC Mag. Messaging app Signal threatens to dump the U.S. market if anti-encryption bill passes. Signal is warning that an anti-encryption bill circulating in Congress could force the private messaging app to pull out of the U.S. market. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the free app, which offers end-to-end encryption, has seen a surge in traffic. But on Wednesday, the nonprofit behind the app published a blog post raising the alarm about the Earn It Act. At a time when more people than ever are benefiting from these encryption protections, the Earn It bill, proposed by Senate Judiciary Committee, threatens to put them all at risk, Signal developer Joshua Lund wrote in the post. Although the goal of the legislation, which has bipartisan support, is to stamp out online child exploitation, because it always is. Literally, every time they bring up one of these anti-encryption bills, it's always about the child exploitation. I mean, it's the, you know, accusing somebody of Hitler argument. How do you argue against that, right? So.
Yep.
Hitler breathed air. You breathe air. You must be evil. You're just as bad as Hitler because you like sugar. He liked sugar.
We're biologically programmed to like sugar and fat.
Hitler liked dogs, and you like dogs. You must be Hitler. Sorry.
Hitler painted landscapes. I have no artistic talent at all. Oh, wait a minute. Hitler had no artistic talent when it came to faces. Oh, God.
I'm sorry.
I have to hate the Jews.
That's my point. It's just how stupid these arguments get, right? Because it's like it's always online child exploitation. That's always the boogeyman. And it's like, you know, guys, yes, that's bad. And we don't want it to happen. But it's already illegal. I mean, we don't need to cripple the internet to stop something that's already illegal. I mean, you know, if somebody is actually exploiting a child and is posting videos of it online, I hope they get decapitated with a dull ceiling fan. But I don't think that needs to be the boogeyman that's used every time the government wants to pass an internet law. So, yeah. That would suck, getting decapitated by a dull ceiling fan. I mean, that'd probably take a couple of hits to do it.
Depends on how fast it's going.
But if you're a pedophile, you deserve it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, if you're a pedophile, I hope, you know, an Islamic fundamentalist comes at you with a pocket knife.
Yeah, he'd probably call you brother.
Hey, just because Muhammad banged a 9-year-old doesn't mean they all do it.
We have really hit every corner we possibly could on this show today, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
They should name these bills, "We want everyone to steal your money and see your health records." That would get people at least looking at them. That's why I am pro-encryption. I don't think anyone should be able to steal my money. Actually, I don't really care about my health records. But I don't think anyone should be able to steal my fucking money. And my bank needs this encryption.
So, I take it to a more basic level than that. If I am encrypting communications and information, it's data. At the end of the day, the worst thing that can go across an encrypted channel is saying something mean or posting a disturbing photo or video, right? So it's information. It's data. I don't think you should be sharing photos of children, you know, whatever fits the definition of child exploitation. I don't think that should be happening. But it's information, right? I mean, it's in the case of child exploitation, it's documentation of a crime. But I think you should find the person who was hurting the child and, you know, castrate them with whatever blunt instrument you have at hand. I don't think you need to destroy encryption because people hurt children. I think you should stop people hurting children because it's already illegal. Am I explaining this well? I mean, you understand what I mean,
right? As far
as
the argument, you have to explain what is harmful about breaking encryption. What's harmful about breaking encryption is what's keeping my money safe.
All online transactions, if you're buying something on Amazon or doing your banking online, which everyone is right now because we're all locked in our homes because General So's revenge. I still have in the show notes just the list of alternative names that we put together a couple of weeks ago. So I'm just, you know. Anyways, back to the article. Although the goal of the legislation, which has bipartisan support, is to stamp out online child exploitation, it does so by letting the U.S. government regulate how internet companies should combat the problem, even if it means undermining the end-to-end encryption protecting your messages from snoops. If the companies fail to do so, they risk losing immunity under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which can shield them from lawsuits concerning objectionable or illegal content posted on their websites or apps. So, translation. Right now, if somebody goes on YouTube and posts a video of them
setting a dog on fire,
hurting a child, setting a dog on fire, something horrible and illegal, YouTube itself is not going to get shut down for that, especially if they follow the provision of the thing and pull the content down, as soon as they know it's up. And given the size of YouTube, it might take a minute before somebody's reported it and they notice it and they pull the damn thing down, right? We've done articles about all the moderators at YouTube, Facebook, Microsoft, who, you know, have had really, really bad times with all this shit they have to put up with, right? So,
again, I'll do the job. Just let me hook a USB in there.
And so what they're saying is if you don't play nice with them telling you when you can and cannot use encryption, they can take your immunity away so that, oh, somebody posted something naughty on your website, we're shutting your website down and suing you for it. Because you haven't followed the guidelines that we've laid out. Which means, theoretically, anything that allows content to be posted that doesn't play nice with the Earn It Act, meaning they don't keep the logs the government tells them to keep or they don't allow backdoor access or whatever, can have their immunity revoked. And if you want to go into, Dirty Tricks Teams territories, it would be very easy for a Dirty Tricks Team to go on a website that's not playing ball, post something horrible, illegal, objectionable, you know, use your imagination, and then come in and say, look what we found on your website, and since you're not complying with Earn It, you don't have protection, and now you're going to jail because somebody posted something horrible on your website. You want to talk about a chilling effect? There it is. Is that a little bit of... am I maybe overstepping the... No, I think it's a logical conclusion. I don't think that's going to happen overnight. But I think it's possible, and I don't think it's going to happen to YouTube. I don't think it's going to happen to Facebook. It's going to happen to Minds. It's going to happen to what's the one?
It's going to happen to someone that doesn't have lawyers on retainer.
Right. What's the one you like lately? Are you BitChute?
I'm on the dick of BitChute. But there's a new player in town already, man.
Yeah, it's going to be sites like that. You know, because the big boys will be able to play nice with the government, or at least pay the lawyers, and if nothing else, buy them off. And you see it in other industries. That kind of regulation, you essentially lock in the big players and you stop seeing churn in the market. Or at least it becomes a lot more rare. So...
Can you name an automobile company that did not split from an existing automobile company in the last your lifetime?
There's one example, and it was funded by a billionaire who got his money mostly from the government. Tesla. Tesla's the only one.
And it was funded by the U.S. government and a pre-existing billionaire.
Yeah. So.
And I think the U.S. government's a majority shareholder or was at one point.
They certainly were. And the only reason Tesla was even viable in the early days was all the rebates because of his electric car. So, yeah, I mean, that's my point. Is once you start getting these kind of regulations in place, Facebook, Google, Twitter, that's it. You're not going to have new companies springing up. Or if you do, they're going to get shut down real damn quick or bought out. But, you know, these main companies are it. They're going to be locked in place. And you're going to see these regulations coming in because a big company likes regulations. They can deal with it. They can deal with the bureaucracy. They have the resources. They have the manpower where they can, you know, put the manpower in place to deal with this crap.
They have regulatory capture. Governments don't generally write a lot of these bills. They have business write a book.
So,
yeah.
Big players are in the boardroom with the intern because it's not even your congressman writing half this shit. It's something they actually believe in at one of their pet projects. But it's the intern, a couple of guys from whatever industry they're attempting to regulate, and the bigger players because they're the experts.
So let's get back to the article here. Some larger tech behemoths could hypothetically shoulder the enormous financial burden of handling hundreds of new lawsuits if they suddenly became responsible for the random things their users say, but it would not be possible for a small nonprofit like Signal to continue to operate within the United States, Lund wrote in the blog post. Why Signal is concerned the bill will undermine end-to-end encryption is because it gives the U.S. Attorney General, in this case William Barr, a major critic of encryption, the power to dictate how internet companies fight online child exploitation. In recent months, Barr has been calling on Facebook to reverse a plan to extend end-to-end encryption across its services on claims that the technology is preventing law enforcement from tracking down criminals, including child sex offenders. Companies should not deliberately design their systems to preclude any form of access to content, even for preventing or investigating the most serious crimes, Barr wrote to Facebook back in October. This puts our citizens and societies at risk by severely eroding a company's ability to detect and respond to illegal content and activity such as child sexual exploitation and abuse or terrorism. However, Signal says the efforts to undermine end-to-end encryption risk do more harm to innocent users than actual criminals who will simply choose other ways to make their domestic activities online. If easy-to-use software like Signal somehow became inaccessible, the security of millions of Americans, including elected officials and members of the armed forces, would be negatively affected, Lund added. Meanwhile, criminals would just continue to use widely available but less convenient software to jump through hoops and keep having encrypted conversations.
They're going to open up a BBS.
Well, there's an actually, Madman, it's even simpler than that. The encryption software exists. It's open source. It's out there. Things like, it's not TrueCrypt anymore. I keep forgetting what the new one's called. Anyways, disk encryption software exists. Open source, based on math. It's based on actual, you know, algorithms that we know are secure and work presently today. That'll change over time, but it's why you constantly see the churn on what algorithms and what encryption you use, because over time computers get stronger and it's easier to break them. But as it is today, the software exists and is open source and is out there. And you have things like Tor, which are open and exist and are out there and are end-to-end encrypted if set up properly. Not to mention things like GPG, not to mention, we were talking about Jitsi, I think, on the last show, apparently supports end-to-end encryption. it's that genie is out of the bottle. And it can be attacked, you can do the cat and mouse game, but, you know, I can take a modern encryption algorithm, or a couple of them, actually, and put together something that, you know, even computers 10 years from now would have a hard time cracking. And, you know, just by doing things like, you know, one of the best examples of making encryption stronger without actually having to change it very much technically was moving from DES to triple DES. Do you know what they did? Because the NSA developed
this. They ran it through
there three times. They ran DES three times. And suddenly, it was damn near impossible to decrypt. Now, today, they still have attacks against it. A lot of times, the attacks against these actual encryption algorithms are implementation problems, not so much problems with the math. Generally, anymore, when you're attacking the actual math, that means you're trying them all. You're bringing up a collection of computers, You've come up with a way to do lots of parallel processing, whether that's stacks of computers or stacks of graphics cards, or you know, maybe you're paying and using the cloud processing stuff. I mean, there's a couple different ways to do this shit. But when you're attacking the math of encryption, you're just trying everything till you get your expected clear text back by feeding in data. Or, you know, you have some method of knowing you've cracked the encryption and you're just trying them all until you get a way in. So one of the easiest defeats to that is things like triple DES, just using longer encryption keys, things that are harder to crack. You know, they say not to use MD5 anymore, but if you look at the existing attacks against MD5, it's not trivial to, you know, craft MD5 hashes that collide with existing things. I mean, it's out there. There are write-ups of how to do it, but, you know, it's not trivial.
Resource intensive.
Yeah.
It's not, I'm not going to crack it at home. It's you've pissed off a three-letter agency,
they might,
or a corporation,
sure.
Someone with resources.
So I guess the point I'm making is encryption is out there. If somebody is truly running some kind of an organization based around it, cracking the encryption and monitoring everybody's activities is not how you're going to stop them. You're going to have to do old-fashioned police work of figuring out who's doing the bad stuff, monitoring them, putting bugs on their devices, doing police work, not putting out a dragnet, monitoring everyone's communications and hoping to catch the bad guys. Because the NSA has been monitoring everybody's calls for 15-ish years now. I forget exactly when they implemented it. It wasn't immediately after 9/11, which is why I'm guessing at the date. And how many mass shootings have we heard about them stopping? How many, you know, terrorist events have we heard about them stopping with, you know, the phone monitoring, the communication?
Mass shootings, I don't think they've stopped any. Now, as far as everything else, you're not going to hear about it because whenever they use their nice little surveillance thing, they set up what is known as a parallel investigation. And this is to get around needing to release to the defense team how information was found.
Point is, it's not that often. I mean, it happens, but it's pretty rare. And usually they've got some reason to be looking at that person first anyways.
Yeah, I'll go with usually they had a reason to look at him first. But my point with the description is we don't know how rare. I'll assume that it's rare. But I'll have to say it is innocent.
Okay.
Now, I don't think they've stopped any mass shootings because mass shootings tend to be more spree than planned. Terrorist attacks can be pretty planned.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is they're already doing some of these operations. And I don't I'm not restricting
it
to one political party.
Effective.
And they're not doing much. Bush did it. Obama did it. Trump's doing it. What are you accomplishing? Besides blackmailing some people in government, which we're, you know, assume they're doing.
Oh, I know that's happening.
I mean, you know, they've gotten in trouble for, checking up on old girlfriends and shit like that before, so you know they're doing worse than that, but
I think they're blackmailing old girlfriends?
Fuck, I don't know. Probably.
And possibly blackmailing members of the opposite political party.
Well, I'm fairly certain that's happening. I mean, they've caught Schiff releasing shit that he got from FISA courts to reporters a couple of times during the Trump stuff. So you know it happens more often than that, and it's just people more competent than Adam Schiff doing it that don't get caught. So, man, he looks like Alfred E. Newman, doesn't he? Anyways.
I don't want to insult Alfred E. Newman.
Yeah, fair point. In case my own politics weren't known, I mean... Anyways,
I don't know. We're going to have to own it. It was a big problem. The Republicans came up with FISA. I hate all of them that voted for it, but
yeah, it cannot be managed properly. It needs to stop. And this whole we can't have encryption unless the government approves it thing is not practical. It's very similar to the same argument of, well, if we just banned all guns, then you know, criminals wouldn't have guns. No, only criminals would have guns at that point. Would you reduce the amount of guns out there in circulation? Yeah, probably, but there's a lot out there today. It'd be generations before you got rid of them all if you banned guns. So
you'll still never get rid of them all.
Yeah, probably. Not to mention anybody with a lathe and a mill. I mean, put one together.
And it's not the guns that you need to get rid of. It's the guns in criminals' hands. How many of them are going to turn them in? Same thing with the encryption.
Yeah, I mean,
you can now see Madman's checking account. Did the pedophile stop using encryption? I don't think he did.
Well, the stupid ones did because they were using with the same service as, you know, your bank. But anybody who's mildly intelligent, I mean, you know, if they're that insistent on doing this shit online, they're going to go to Tor. They're going to go to other things that, I mean, okay, great. You've now made encryption impossible and ran a bunch of services out of the country and ensured that only the current big players can comply with it. Congratulations. Did you solve the problem? Oh, no, guess not. So, because I like to assume these people aren't complete tossers, that means they must know that, and instead that's not, the goal is not what the stated goal is. The goal is something else.
The goal is always something else.
Most likely keeping the big players in power because they're lobbying for it, and yep, they can deal with it, and they don't want to see competition. But
the BitChute's got to be hurting YouTube by now.
I don't know. Last couple of times I went on BitChute looking for 3D printing videos, I wasn't finding much. I still have to go to YouTube for a lot of that.
Yeah, it doesn't sort like that.
So
you got to know the actual account. It won't actually sort it into categories for you.
You
got to know the user.
Yeah, that's the problem. Is it's harder to discover content that way. That is one thing Google really got right, is getting the discoverability down.
Yeah, but that just made it easier for all the fucking pusses out there to start flagging shit.
Oh, no, no argument there.
I like BitChute, man. If you're not into it, you can't find it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I gotcha.
It just keeps the complainers away.
I would just go with revise your flagging system.
Well, like I said, I mean, you know, I give Google props for getting discoverability right. Now, the fact that people abuse that to mass flag and play politics is, you know, shitty. But what else? I mean, I don't disagree with you. I just,
well, I'm looking at this new one right now, and there's zero moderation.
So
they're starting to get some finger holds into the mountain's face that is video online. But a lot of people are switching to them because it's zero moderation. Do whatever the fuck you want over there.
You ever looked into Gab?
Maybe? There was the reason I stopped looking at Gab, and I can't remember what it was. But God, I miss StreamMe.
Yeah, they must have threatened that guy's kids or something, because that thing just disappeared overnight. Oh, they did? Did they figure out that's what it was?
Yeah.
Fuck.
They sent photos to the dude. They sent photos of his kids at school to him. So
that's fucked up, man. It's a website.
That's the story I heard, anyway, that they actually came after his kids.
Over a fucking website. I mean,
yep.
You know, this goes back to, you remember my amazement when we first started decking and you had people getting arrested in London for tweeting shit. It's like, what the fuck? They posted bullshit on the internet? What do you think the internet's for?
Porn.
And posting bullshit, yeah.
Yep.
Often at the same time.
Often posting shitty porn.
Maybe if you're in the mood for some strange, you might be able to do both.
Gross. Anyways.
Next story.
This one is from Ars Technica. I think Psychro sent me a similar story. I don't think it was this link, though. Again, I put a bunch of them together, then I checked what Psychro sent me. He sent me several links. One of them, which really should be an IGN story, but I've got it in here because it's funny. Senator backing anti-crypto bill calls out Zoom's lack of end-to-end crypto, meaning he doesn't understand what he's voting for. Richard Blumenthal, shining beacon that he is, the U.S. senator sponsoring a bill that critics say will limit the use of encryption, and we're talking about the Earn It Act, by the way, is calling for an investigation of video conferencing provider Zoom, in part over its false claim it offered end-to-end encryption.
We were already compliant with the act that you're pushing, sir.
The Connecticut Democrat is a sponsor of the Earn It, Eliminating Abusive and Rampant Negligence of Interactive Technologies Act. God, somebody really, they must have a consultancy making stupid amounts of money in Washington coming up with this shit. A bill that would create incentives for companies to make changes to their platforms. In return, the companies would receive liability protections for any violations of laws related to online child sexual abuse material. Critics of the proposed law, who include the Electronic Frontier Foundation Senator Ron Wyden, say it's a Trojan horse designed to allow the government to weaken end-to-end encryption. A Blumenthal representative disagreed. It wasn't him himself, because he didn't understand it, obviously, because he's getting on Zoom. A Blumenthal representative disagrees with the characterization and says the bill doesn't hamper encryption. I'm Joe Biden, and I don't understand this message. I've been drinking. Anyways, citing a pattern of security failures and privacy infringements, Senator Blumenthal on Tuesday called for the FTC to investigate Zoom. Chief among the cited privacy infringements was the claim on Zoom's website that meetings were end-to-end encrypted, meaning video, audio, and text was encrypted at all times in transit and could not be decrypted by Zoom or anyone else other than conference participants. A post published last week by The Intercept reported Zoom meetings, in fact, used what's called transport encryption, which allowed Zoom to decrypt meeting data. Researchers from Citizens Lab, University of Toronto group that investigates security flaws. I'm not going to sit here and... Okay, the rest of this is all boilerplate. We know it all. The joke here is Blumenthal is sponsoring the Earn IT Act and then is getting on Zoom for not doing end-to-end encryption.
Zoom should just have one of its representatives walk in. We understand, sir. We read this act that you're sponsoring and decided to be compliant with it early. We also support the Earn Act.
You can't see me sitting here shaking my head with my hand on my face.
No, don't touch your face. You're not supposed to touch your face.
I don't know. Have you washed your hand recently?
Too much.
I say this as I face palm all day long, right? So,
yeah, I know, man. But if you're like me, you're practicing best practice. If you go out in public, come home, shower, put your clothes in a fucking plastic bag, have one area for your shoes.
I'm not using a plastic bag. I'm just throwing them straight in the washing machine, and when it gets full,
dude, you live on your own, right?
True.
So it doesn't matter for you. But here are you to wash. Cross-contamination. Get to practice best practice. Came home yesterday with the groceries and shit, man. Took them out on the bench, put them away, then wiped the bench down.
So
wash my hands.
You're going to need... What you need to do is cut up some trash bags and put them over your door so that when you walk in, you get a sprayed with a 50-50 bleach water solution. So you have a decon tent, basically.
Oh, dude, there's that's over the top, but yeah, if I was living on my own, you want to bet I'd have full decontamination fucking room.
But, yeah, it's called the shower.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just rule of thumb, man. The minute you go out the front door, you don't touch your face. You know, wash your hands the minute you come inside. So the front door is the only thing you're touching with your outside hands.
I found a box of rubber gloves that I bought for doing painting. So I'm actually good on gloves for a while. So that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, but dude, gloves give you a false sense of security because you're walking around the house touching everything with the same gloves.
No, you're not. No. You misunderstand me, sir. The box of gloves stays in the car under the seat because I don't want to get my car robbed. But when I am done, I pull the gloves off and turn them inside out in the car. So when I get out, yeah, okay, I'm touching the front door with my hands. But, yeah, I don't wear the gloves inside. That's just when I go in public.
Okay, yeah.
And actually, I got a cloth face mask in the mail from my mom this morning. She's been making them and donating to the hospital.
Awesome.
So she sent me one.
Thank you, Morp's mom. Lovely lady she is. So, don't worry about the virus in your car. Just park it in the sun.
Well, that kind of already happens. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So this next article is interesting. It's from The Verge. A lot of people are upset about it, but I appreciate it. Twitter notifies its users that it's now sharing more data with advertisers. In other words, they're being straight with their users.
Yep.
I appreciate that. Means I'm not using a Twitter account anytime soon, but they're being honest with their users about what they're doing. Twitter has removed a privacy feature that allowed all users to stop sharing some private information with advertisers. The setting prevented Twitter from sharing information like the ads you saw or interacted with and the tracking identifier for your phone. For most users, that information will now be shared by default and cannot be turned off. What this likely means is Twitter was doing it anyways, regardless of what the setting was, and now they're just being straight about it. I don't know that.
Like that
I'm not
for most users.
Yeah. That's because in Europe they get an exception because of the blanking on the name of it now. The privacy regulation.
Euro Act. Will...
Yeah, yeah. It's probably in the article. Let's see. The shared data is used to show the efficacy of advertising on Twitter, the company says. It helps Twitter to prove that people are actually watching, interacting with, and otherwise seeing the ads that advertisers are paying for. Nobody interacts with those. They just scroll past them. Come on. We all know this. Which helps the company continue operating as a free service. An option in Twitter's privacy settings called Share Your Data with Twitter's Business Partners used to let you disable sharing of this information. That setting still exists, but Twitter now says it has removed your control over the mobile app advertising measurements. Disabling the setting can still prevent the sharing of other information, such as your interests. Other Twitter privacy settings, like disabling web tracking, are still available. Twitter will not share your name, email address, phone number, or username. There is one major set of exceptions. This mobile ad data will still be kept private for Twitter users in the European Union, the European Free Trade Association, and the United Kingdom. They'll have to opt into sharing the information should they wish to let Twitter share more information about them. Twitter alerted users to the change with a pop-up that when they opened the app starting around 11 a.m. Eastern today. They say today. That was actually the 8th. A Twitter spokesperson said the update is part of our ongoing work around transparency and control. We want to ensure that people understand the settings we provide, what they do, and how to use them. Even users who had not disabled sharing data received the alert. The availability of ad data has a big impact on Twitter's earnings last year. Twitter blamed a missed earning on a bug that prevented it from properly using and sharing this kind of ad data. Blah, 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 blah. So, anyways, I appreciate Twitter's honesty. It's like, nope, we're sharing your information with advertisers no matter what, because that's how we make our money.
You are the product, sir.
That's right.
Thank you for being a good product.
And I'm okay with that, by the way. I don't have a problem with that because Twitter's being upfront about it. Where I have a
Would
problem...
Would you like a discount for being our product?
Yes. That's the thing. If you have a choice and they're telling you what's up, okay. I'm fine with that. I don't have a problem with it. It means I don't have to use their service if I don't want to. You know, where I have a problem with it is when they're doing this shit and they don't tell you about it. And then they lie to your face about it, like Facebook. And you constantly reset your privacy settings to, you know, things that support their business model. That was the one with Facebook that always pissed me off, is no matter what your privacy settings were, they seemed to reset them every couple of months back to, you know, what they wanted them to be.
Oh, they were just doing a random systems update. It had nothing to do with it. I read that.
They were targeting me personally.
Not like Jones Cola targeting me, not selling the regular cherry soda fucking east of the Basin-Dixie line. I'm sorry, Mississippi River.
I've heard about probably gang commies. Stalking. That's a thing.
Yeah, but I stopped stalking the Bloods and the Crips when I realized I kept getting their colors confused, and they shoot at you when you do that.
How do you confuse one called the Bloods? I mean, come on.
Hey, have you ever, you know, seen pictures of your blood? Depending on whether it's going back to your heart or from your heart, it can be red, purple, or blue. You have three fucking options. Damn it!
Your veins are not actually blue. They just look that way. Anyways, RU, do you have anything on this before we move on?
No, I'm good, man.
All right. This next article RU sent to me, it's from the New York Post. And it's very sensationalist. It's not as bad as it sounds. Nursing home patient asked Alexa for help before dying from coronavirus. I'm forgetting to substitute in things like the whooping cough when I read this, aren't I?
This is the first time I've noticed it.
Yeah.
I just now realized it. Okay. A 66-year-old Michigan nursing home patient suffering from the boomer and tumor. Oh, she died, though. That's a bad one to use for that. Damn it.
Possibly completely accurate.
The Winnie the Flu turned to her Amazon Echo show in her final days, pleading for help from Alexa to cope with her pain before dying, according to a report. Lou Ann Dagan was one of 31 residents and five staffers at the Metron of Cedar Springs who tested positive for the incident, according to Wood TV. Dagan, who was quarantined along with the other residents in a separate section of the home, pleaded in desperation with the virtual assistant dozens of times before dying Saturday at a hospital in Grand Rapids, the station reported. So it's presented, and this is something Ari and I were talking about. The article's presented like they stuck this woman in the back corner of a residential home, and you know she was pleading with Alexa to get somebody to help her before she died. That's not what happened. She was in the hospital, right?
Yeah. The first half of the article is incredibly misleading.
Oh, especially when they get to the quotes here. Yeah, her sister, Penny Dagan, discovered the 40 heartbreaking recordings on the device. "Alexa, help me," Luann was heard saying at one point, according to a recording her sister shared with a news outlet at her home in Sparta. "I am in pain. I have to find a way to relieve it," the ailing woman told Alexa. "Can you help me cope with the pain? Oh, Alexa, I'm going to hurt," she said. Luann also asked for help reaching law enforcement. "How do I get to the police?" she said, according to the recording, which showed she was then provided with directions to the nearest police station. Oh, man.
It's brutal.
It's brutal. It really is. I just kept telling her there wasn't anything I could do, Penny said as she tearfully apologized to her younger sister. "I'm sorry I couldn't help you more. I'd take your pain away," she said. Luann, who suffered from diabetes and hypertension, had been living at Metron ever since she survived a stroke almost 10 years ago, the station reported. So now we're getting into the reality of this. Last week, she had been short of breath, but Metron officials said that she did not have a fever, Penny said. "It wasn't until Thursday when they started the saline solution because she was getting dehydrated," Penny said. She said she just kept saying, "I'm thirsty." She didn't drink anything, though. On Saturday, Luann's oxygen level and blood pressure dropped, prompting the nursing home to send her to Mercy's Health, St. Mary's, where she went into convulsions, Penny said. So she was not abandoned in the back room with an Alexa, you know, begging for help.
No.
She was in a hospital, and the nursing home was obviously monitoring her and went, oh, something's wrong, and sent her to the hospital, right? I know how the article's presented, and that's why I keep interjecting here, is because I don't think it's right to do that. Because obviously anybody thinking about their grandparent left in a nursing home with nothing for a company but an Alexa is going to get pissed, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So, the hospital called me right away and said that they had put her on a respirator. Then they asked me about giving her CPR if her heart stopped, and I said, no, she doesn't want that. They're talking to her sister. And then her heart stopped, and that was it, about a half hour after they called. Her death was caused by coronavirus infection, diabetes, and hypertension, the medical examiner's office told the outlet. So this is what Madman and we were talking about earlier, that it's like right now if anybody dies and they test positive for the virus, they're listing the virus as the cause of death, which in her case it very well could have been the trigger, right? I don't know. But let's see. It's good to know she's not in pain anymore, but I miss her. Peggy told Wood TV. She's up in heaven now, so she's pain-free. She's walking with my mom and dad, so I'm happy for her. Paul Pruitt, director of operations for the nursing home, said in a statement to the Post that Alexa was Luann's primary communication tool with her sister, who was unable to get out to our facility. Which, you know, right now everybody's in a lockdown, so that makes sense. She could call her sister through the device, and they communicated often. It was a very positive part of her life, which we supported fully, Pruitt said. due to patient privacy regulations, we cannot share information about an individual resident's physical or mental health while they were in our care. However, we can share that Luann was getting excellent care and that our team was following both her advanced directives and clinical practice guidelines to manage her pain and symptoms, he continued. Once these symptoms progressed rapidly and at the advice of her medical team, she was immediately sent to the hospital, Pruitt added. Thoughts and prayers to Luann DeGrane's family. She has been a resident of community and care for 10 years, and we care for her deeply, he said. So, the article is presented as though, you know, somebody left an old woman to die in a room with an Alexa, right? That's not, no. No.
No.
But, that's journalistic malfeasance there.
It was, yeah.
But there are recordings on the Alexa of basically this elderly woman who is dying pleading for help.
Yeah, that's the brutal part of it.
My God, can you imagine being a family member and finding that?
Nope. I could be furious.
I mean, you know, even though you know the nursing home obviously was monitoring her, sent her to the hospital, was trying to help her. But, I mean, my God.
But, I mean, the last thing you call out to is not God, it's Alexa. For fuck's sake. You know, how far we've fallen as a species.
On this one, they said the Alexa was actually used to communicate with her sister.
Yeah, you can use them as a speakerphone. I've got people at work who do that.
If it's being used to communicate with her sister, and it's able to call out, when she asked for the police, why didn't it call the police and instead of just giving her directions?
You've used these things. You know that they don't always understand you.
Okay, yeah. I guess you may have needed to say, call the police.
As opposed to, how do I get the police? Yeah,
the police, yeah.
Yeah.
Not to mention, if she's dying, she's probably not in the greatest of mental shape. So she's probably not making great
sort of
requests.
Breaths.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's probably having trouble, you know, talking to start with, or even drawing breath to ask the question. But anyway, I've made everyone's Friday shit now.
But there's a real conversation here. What? Okay, somebody says, help Alexa, I'm dying. What should the thing do? Because, you know, how often have you heard somebody gasping for air and saying, I'm dying, because they're laughing so hard at something stupid, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, somebody's literally in the hospital dying of, in this case, sweet and sour sicken. What should it do?
Confirm that you want it to call the cops and then call the cops?
Yeah. I mean, there's something, yeah, there's a real question there of, I mean, you know, from a privacy standpoint, I don't like the thing listening to me all the time, which is why I don't have one. And I occasionally test my phone and a few other devices I have that I know support these things to make sure they're not actually listening. This is how I discovered if you're running Google Maps, even though you have the Google Assistant turned off on Android phones, Google Maps turns it back on only while driving. Mm-hmm. Or only while following directions, I guess, you know, so that you can use it while driving. But that's really funny because I was actually listening to a podcast where somebody was joking about giving Google fake instructions and it fucking did it. It's like, damn it, no, cancel. So, and it's like, I didn't think anything about it. And it's like, I have all this turned off. What the fuck, Google Maps? Oh my God.
Yep.
So, because of course I was driving somewhere and didn't know how to get there and was using the damn GPS, right? So, you know. Yeah, I do randomly announce to the various assistants to see if anything in my house triggers, because you never know when an iPad or a cell phone or a Fire TV has gotten an update to just turn the damn microphone on. I've got a new Android box in that I've been testing, pretty much ready to unplug the Fire TV and chuck it in the trash, but. Yeah, I was still using it the other day, so, you know. Anyways, yeah, in this case, I mean, I get why they left the Alexa in there, because I could see somebody who's, you know, crippled up and elderly being able to just, you know, say to the voice assistant, do something. I could see that being really useful, and at that point in your life, who the fuck cares about privacy, right? But I don't know. I don't like the idea that Amazon's like, here's all these recordings for you of your sister dying. So, oh, I guess
what
we
else
have.
Are they going to do with them? They are that woman's property at that point.
You're right, and you don't want somebody reviewing them to determine whether or not they should, you know, pass them on. But all right, we're getting on time, so. Anyways, last article, and Psychro sent me this one. This is from Vice. This smart toilet will know you by the shape of your asshole.
Well, yeah, it's gonna
picture my pucker. I thought it's gonna know me because it's gonna, you know, analyze what I crap.
A team of researchers at Stanford University developed a prototype smart toilet with four cameras. They can
Nope.
They can identify users based on their anal print.
Nope.
Oh, think of all the fetish porn that this thing's going to create.
Nope.
I'm just going to keep reading the article while RU says nope in the background. Your butthole.
RU Scheisser videos.
Your butthole is like a snowflake. No two are exactly alike. God.
Don't care.
We are not beautiful and unique snowflakes. We are the all singing, all dancing crap of the universe.
At least that's the crux of a new scientific paper outlining the mechanism for a smart toilet that identifies poopers based on video clips of their unique anuses.
Oh, hell no.
I don't know why. Why do you need to identify the user of a toilet? I mean, are you making a seating adjustments? Are you raising and lowering the height? Do you have bidet preferences? And why do you have accurate pictures in the article?
Is there a regular and race mode? Like, no. No, this should not. These people didn't stop to think, should we? They just did it. Like, somewhere out there, like, Madman just going, you beautiful bastards, you did it. Like, this is the greatest thing ever. And I'm like, nope.
Each user of the toilet is identified through their fingerprint and the distinctive features of their abdomen. The researchers write. And the data is securely stored and analyzed in an encrypted cloud server. So there's not even, the toilet has a cloud server.
Definitely not. Nope. Nope.
The abdomen is the scientific word. Oh, I said abdomen. That was wrong. It's anoderm. Anoderm. is the
parabolic sphincter. It's your parabolic sphincter.
The scientific word for your asshole skin. Etymologically, a combination of the anus and derm or skin. Rather than sending people to a clinic or labs for expensive or multiple time-consuming blood tests, the researchers posit that the most valuable health data is in our shit, spit, and piss. They write that the ideal sources of diagnostic information for continuous health monitoring are potentially information-rich molecular contents of breath, sweat, saliva, urine, and stool. Their prototype mounts to an existing toilet, and the user flush lever fingerprinting, anal print recognition, an incredible phrase, thank you, science, and analyzes urine and stool, as well as the speed and timing of your business, all done using two-factor authentication. They're measuring how long you shit.
Now it's like a test? You've got to be done within what? Fuck you. Everything about that.
Your government medical team has determined that your average shit should be exactly 15 minutes. If you go across 15 minutes, we will be notifying an ambulance.
Look inside your asshole. Like, this is some South Park toilet fucking TSA.
For pee.
Like, next thing you know, like, you want to wear a 5-point fucking harness just in case you fall off it.
For pee analysis, there are two high-speed cameras watching the flow rate, and a stack analysis of your analysis strips are loaded into the back of the seat.
Are you going to get a ticket for pissing too quick?
A passive infrared motion sensor detects when you start peeing and slides out a strip.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
The test system was tested on both one male and one female participant, the paper notes, but it is designed for men to be able to stand and aim directly for the strip.
Does the strip have a picture of James Fonda on it?
Wait, no.
It should. If it wants me to piss on it, it has to have a picture of James Fonda on it.
I don't care. No pictures. No infrared. No wait, no time. Like,
for poop analysis, a pressure sensor activates a video camera that captures images of the toilet bowl from clean to shat to covered in toilet paper. These images are fed to a neural network, which determines the time from which the first kid is dropped off at the pool to the last, which is significantly correlated with overall bowel function.
Oh, what if you freckle the underside of the seat? Do they have a camera to catch that?
God damn it.
Do you occasionally have to clean things off?
Play the racist music. Next segment. I'm done. We're not doing any more. Thank you. It's your fault, madman. Hang your head.
We're talking about pressure. Sometimes when you
fuck
relate.
No. Moving on. I'm done. Too close to my lunchtime. Move on.
Oh, if we weren't like an hour and 35 minutes in.
See, this is what happens when the nicotine levels get low. I get angry. Won't put up with it.
I put the link in the TeamSpeak there, Madman, so when you want to continue at your own leisure.
You can speculate your fucking heart away reading it then, Madman. Just as long as I don't have to listen to it.
Two things for you tonight. Number two for you tonight in Digital Dojo.
You're pushing it, Wolves.
Yep, pushing a mess. Anyway. Oh, for fuck's sake. The first is a project called Commit Stream. It's an OSINT tool for finding GitHub repositories by extracting commit logs in real time from the GitHub Events API. It's a tool for monitoring GitHub commits. Drinks commit logs from GitHub event firepos, exposing the author's details, name, email address associated with GitHub repositories in real time. The idea is you can uncover repositories in which employees of a target company is committing code, identify repositories belonging to an individual, or chain with other tools such as TruffleHog to extract secrets in unknown repositories. Pretty nice looking tool, especially if you're monitoring GitHub for any particular reason. Did I post links to this? I did not. One second. There's your link into the IRC, even though I don't think anybody's actually active in there because they're not talking back. Here's your link in TeamSpeak. There you go. Final thing for you tonight in Digital Dojo, and this is cool. InfoSec Oasis. InfoSec Oasis is a free online information security conference. And what they're doing is they're basically having a security conference. It's next Saturday in Altspace VR. So if you have a VR headset, you don't have to use one. They've got a way to get into it for, I think, video streams. But, yeah, it's they're going to do it in Altspace VR. Wait, next Saturday? When did I say it was? Yeah, 4/18. So the call for papers is open until April the 9th. So that was today. They're doing, you know, new. They've got a couple on the chart already there. But pretty much, it's a VR security conference. And they're doing a VR security conference because, you know, the Mandarin microbe is, you know, currently got everybody locked down. So I think this is cool. And I don't think I have an Altspace account. I don't remember if I ever set one up, but I have an Oculus Quest, so I'll probably at least be exploring this a little bit.
Cool.
Yeah, I thought so. I wouldn't mind seeing more stuff like this where it's all just done in VR. Of course, you know, you'll have some really horrific marks on your face by the end of it if it's a full all-day conference, right? Because most security talks at conferences are like an hour. And usually after about half an hour in the VR headset, I'm usually ready for a break. Not always, but sometimes, usually. And then if I play the thing, you know, run the battery down the thing, I usually have some lovely marks on my face. So might be a bit much, but I think it's a cool concept. I'd like to see more stuff like that. So we're like at an hour and 40. I don't know how we hit an hour and 40 considering the amount of bullshit, but we did. And so I'm going to finish off the last of my scotch. I've been drinking. I bought like this Johnny Walker sampler pack a while back and decided now is a good time to start busting out these little bottles. So this was Gold Label Reserve. It was pretty good. I don't know what a big bottle of it costs, but probably a lot because it was in the sampler pack. So anyways, that's all I have for tonight. Madman, closing thoughts.
I'm drinking Woodford's and it's pretty good.
Woodford's is good. Are you? Closing thoughts.
I'm too poor. I've just got tap water.
Well, yeah, but you're in Australia, so I just assume it's Foster's coming out of the top there, tap there.
I think, fuck, it's not.
They got something drinkable.
I'd rather use a toilet cam than drink that shit.
All right. I'm going to stop the joke there because you did about murder Fox at a meetup. I mean, dude went across a table at him over a Foster's joke. So
I thought it was because he was keeping the Fosters away from him.
Anyway,
remember that joke next meetup. I want to see RU kick Madman's ass. That'll be hilarious. Because RU is literally like a third the size of Madman.
I was going to say, there's little to fuck all chance of that.
Be like Wolverine fighting the Blob. It'll be amazing to watch. Anyways.
Good night, everybody.
Madman not touching that one?
No, I thought I messed with him enough when I mentioned freckling the underside of the toilet.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Time to go nose down and call it a night.